From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. From my house, from his house, is our guest whose newest project is the Amazon series, Tales from the Loop, and whose other films include One Hour Photo and Never Let Me Go, Mark Romanek. Mark, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Elvis. It's nice to connect with you.
One of the things that works so well about this show is that it really takes its time. Is that one of the things that attracted you to it?
Well, when you read the script, it almost suggested a certain kind of pace that was baked into the way the story was told. And then there were many conversations as we were, you know, figuring out, you know, the whole world of the show and how we're going to cinematize Simon's paintings. One of the many discussions that we had was about how can we make a pace that's doesn't bore people but suggests that this is a show that you want to kind of ease into, and it's not going to be hurling action sequences or violence at you all the time. Let's just sort of settle in and take a pace that's maybe a little out of step with other shows, but it was very important to us. We really worked a lot trying to modulate that so it wouldn't drive people crazy, but which I think it does drive a few people crazy, but most people have settled into this, and just coincidentally with this terrible pandemic, there was something soothing about the pace, which was also intended.
Time is such an important force in the show, isn't it?
It's Nathaniel's brilliant conceit that because they're doing these experiments with the eclipse in a facility called the Loop, 600 feet underground, that everything above ground, you know, time, space, memory, identity, these things all become malleable or flexible or morphable. And that allows him to use that as a sort of a great storytelling tool and a very original, I think, storytelling tool to explore more intimate human stories in an original way, I think.
I was wondering about the size and texture of the original paintings.
Well, they're digital paintings, so I don't know what resolution he works at, but I'm assuming they can be printed quite large. But the paintings, I believe the paintings that are done for Loop are all done digitally. So size becomes I don't know how you talk about it. He sent us some extremely high resolution images of the book that we had as our reference point. So if we ever needed to zoom in on a detail, we were able to do so.
These paintings have the feel of single frame pieces of storytelling, don't they?
Yeah, to me they had that quality of a Andrew Wyeth painting or an Edward Hopper painting where there's much, 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 much more going on than on the surface. Some images are able to do that and other images just sort of are what they are. Basically, Nathaniel Halpern, and the writer and the showrunner and the executive producer, he managed to mine that enigma without explaining it away. You know, we wanted to keep that enigmatic quality of the paintings alive in cinematic form without it being so ambiguous that, you know, there's no specific point of view. But I thought he did a great job in that respect.
Was it important to develop a sense of place for the show?
Well, you know, I think the general shape of the show, as far as Nathaniel was concerned, was always Winesburg, Ohio. I think Nathaniel just picked an Ohio town and made one up that was sort of somewhat equivalent to the Swedish 80s suburbia that you see in the paintings, but we wanted to set our show in America. So I think that was just a nod to, is it Sherwood Anderson? Yeah.
It could be set almost anywhere, which makes it melancholy and powerful to me.
Well, I'm really big on time, kind of, for certain films, I guess, when you have the opportunity. I guess Never Let Me Go, and this one, you know, it was a sort of timelessness and a placelessness seemed to help make the story seem more resonant. Why that is, I don't know. Other times, maybe you want to be very, very specific, certainly, if you're telling a true story. I think we worked pretty hard to create a kind of a original world that isn't anything in particular. Like, I sent my production designer sent the art directors out in various countries to send back like Soviet and Eastern European and Swedish period knickknacks and telephones and television sets and record players. And and ashtrays and things that just you would never find in an American, you know, maybe antique store. So if you look at it, it's sort of an American, Swedish, Soviet, brutalist, 50s, 80s, you know, it's deliberately very kind of amorphous in that way. I don't know why that just, for me, makes the show seem more interesting. And we also definitely never wanted to fetishize the 80s in the way that, that fun way that Stranger Things does or some other shows. It didn't seem the point of the show is to be nostalgic in any way.
No, because I think that's one of the things that we are so used to now, that when things are set in the 80s, they're really wrapped around 80s pop culture. And this feels, it just doesn't feel like that at all, which is one of the things I think it's gives it a kind of emotional power and I think a unique quality that we get to react to it rather than being told how to react.
Yeah, and it's also, I have kind of a thing about how periods are depicted. They're always so emblematic of the period as they were remembered. But, you know, particularly in a small town in middle America, the 80s aren't the 80s. Everybody doesn't walk around dressed in 80s clothes, driving 80s cars with 80s movies. And the buildings were built in the 30s or the 20s, and people are driving around in older cars they still have from the 60s or 70s. And you know, there's some, maybe there's some specifically 80s stuff here and there, but that's not really how periods really look in real life. So we try to just be accurate to what an 80s might look like, which isn't screamingly 80s all the time. It's just life doesn't work that way, I don't think.
I guess I was going to ask you too, because you've got Philip Glass doing the score, which is a real coup. How did that happen?
Well, you know, Philip was originally involved scoring Never Let Me Go, and we worked together on that for several months, and we never got on the same page about how that music should work. You know, he's one of my heroes and idols, and I was thrilled to work with him, but we parted company on Never Let Me Go very amiably. We just went, God, it's just not clicking for some reason, maybe. So when it came time for this, and because the show is ostensibly set in the 80s, and you know, we played some Glass over some of the paintings and some rehearsals we had done, and there was something that just felt unexpected in a way about it for this show, and more classic. And you know, so I reached out to him again, and we had stayed in touch over the years. And he said he'd be delighted to. He loved the script just like everyone else loved the scripts.
It's the treatment, I guess, who scored one of the coups of television history in getting Philip Glass's score, Tales from the Loop, is director Mark Romanek. I guess I asked you about scale before, because I think there a lot of those paintings we see people sort of foregrounded behind some piece that looks almost like a kind of mid-century Stonehenge, and I think about those structures, some of the buildings we see in the frames, and those kind of interesting visual contradictions must have been something that excited you about the material too.
Yeah, listen, I mean, you know, how it all started is Matt Reeves is an old friend of mine. He said, I've got this great script I think you'd like. I would direct it, but I have to do Batman. I think you're going to like it. And it's based on those paintings by that Swedish guy, Simon Stålenhag. And I said, oh my God, I love those paintings. Those are so cool. I read the script and I was so astounded by the subtlety and the beauty of the script. I just wasn't prepared. I just thought it was going to be more science fiction-y, frankly, or more superficial. So I told Matt, I said, I am way in. You know, I met Nathaniel, who I really liked. He's become a good friend. He's a very, very astute guy, cinematically speaking. He really knows his stuff. And so we started talking about Kieslowski and Bergman and Tarkovsky, and I was like a pig in shit. So I was like, really? Let's not tell the studio about Kieslowski, but this is between us. This is how we're going to approach this, more like Decalogue. So that began that long process of making micro and macro decisions, sometimes even with Simon's help. I will say that what was great is that the studio knew that we really did need to build a world. And so Fox 21 and Amazon, they really stepped up with a decent budget and enough time so that the world could really be built as a designed world. There's no locations in this entire episode. At least my episode has, you know, the only building that was real was, I think, Cole's house, the mid-century house that they go to in the middle of the show. But everything else was constructed, like the freeway overpass was constructed, the entrance to the loop was constructed. Every interior was designed by Philip Messina and and Victor Zolfo. And so, you know, you're able to really try to bring the paintings to life in a much more controlled way that way. And so I appreciate all that support that we got.
One of my regrets in watching it is just you kind of want to see it projected. You do want to see it on the big screen. That's why I was also asking you about what the printouts were like of some of Simon's works. I just wonder about scale, because it feels like something you want to be visually overwhelmed by, because there is this kind of tragic beauty to so much of it.
Well, one thing that I think I tried to bring to the show was that kind of thinking. You know, we shot the show on large format sensor cameras, so you get that large format 70 millimeter kind of quality. So it is sort of a shame. You can sense that quality at home on a good TV or even on your computer, but we were going to have a big premiere at South by Southwest, and I was excited. I've never really seen the show projected, but I wouldn't mind seeing it. I mean, one thing I try to do with my music videos and for television is I never take the attitude, oh, well, it's just a music video, you know, it's just a throwaway little marketing thing. Like, I say, well, this is a piece of filmmaking. How good can we make this? How much can we care about it? You know, and so all of the people that I was able to bring to the show, and I think this is probably one of the best contributions I can say I made to the show, is none of these people have ever worked in television. To your point, Jeff Cronenweth, cinematographer who shoots all of David Fincher's films, he shot One Hour Photo, had never done television. Philip Messina, the production designer who works with Soderbergh, he did all the Ocean's 11, 12, 13 films, and Solaris with Steven Soderbergh. He had never done television. My editor, Leslie Jones, who's won an Oscar with Terrence Malick for Thin Red Line, she had never done television. Philip Glass has never, you know, scripted television. I think he's done some documentaries. So if what you're sensing, and I don't do a ton of television, so if what you're sensing is there's a more of a, definitely there was a feature film sensibility coming in that we were going to stick with.
Yeah, I think that's what I was talking about, or rather what I was trying to get at in terms of scale. There's something about it that feels larger, and there is a kind of a visual gravity, if I can coin such a term, that exists in this thing that I'm not used to seeing in something made for the small screen. And there's this emotional power that comes from looking at something that you realize has a kind of a concentrated effort that we're not used to seeing in TV.
Yeah, and I was really supported in that by everybody, so that's why it was such a terrific experience. You know, I think a good director, I'm not saying I'm a good director, but I think directors have to think all the time about how this image is going to be taken in. And in the old days, it used to be, generally speaking, you knew that it would be taken in on a big screen. And so, you know, you frame and compose and size things very differently based on how it's ultimately meant to be seen. That's why, you know, the great film editor Walter Murch, he used to always have little cutouts of people, like the backs of their heads, and he would tape them to the bottom of his computer monitor or TV monitor when he was editing to remind himself that this is not meant to be seen on a television. But now directors have to kind of create imagery that suggests a grand scale and feels epic, but they know, well, somebody might actually be watching this on their phone or their iPod or their laptop or a really nice, decent-sized TV, and how do you make images that grab you and function in their purpose? You know, shots have purpose. They convey information, the next bit of story information. How do we make sure that that information gets communicated as eloquently and clearly as possible when it's no longer easy for the filmmaker to predict how it's going to be seen? I mean, I think, you know, Da Vinci would paint differently if he knew he was painting a small painting or a grand painting, you know, and it's a bit of a dilemma, you know. And so you try to just sort of make it epic but work in all those possible modes.
Well, we will take a break. My guest, who, despite what he said, is a good director, is Mark Romanek. His latest project is the first episode of the Amazon series, Tales from the Loop. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car. Already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, who directed Never Let Me Go, is Mark Romanek. His other films, of course, include One Hour Photo and the terrific short Static. And one of the things I think that connects all these things to Tales from the Loop, by the way, Mark, is people having a need to believe in something. Your character is wanting to convince somebody else of something they believe that nobody else quite can get their mind around.
The thing is, in Never Let Me Go and in Loop, they're both kind of imagined worlds where science has taken kind of a left turn into an alternate history that never really happened. So while we might look at something like, oh, I came home from school and my house is no longer there, I think the characters that live above and around the Loop for these decades, while they're not used to their house disappearing when they come home from school, there's a different way that they take in information, because since they're born, strange things happen in Mercer, Ohio, you know?
I guess I was thinking about that, because there's a moment where Loretta is going, just trying to get into the factory, and I don't want to give too much away. I don't want to give away story points here. She's talking to a guard who also reemerges in a later episode. At one point, she's trying to convince his character of something, and that happens kind of fairly often in your work. I mean, even going back to Static, somebody trying to convince others of this thing that's kind of hard to explain, so they can't really quite get it across. At some point, there's a fervor in these characters, and that seems to be something that you respond to in narrative terms, dramatic terms, I mean to say.
I don't know. I think I'm on the spectrum somewhere, and, you know, grew up as a very kind of lonely outsider kid, and I think it's very important to feel like you're understood, that you're actually clearly communicating what you're trying, especially if it's something emotional or important to you personally. So maybe it comes from that, you know. I think just getting personal for a moment, that's, you know, if we're, you always ask these self-analytical questions, which I hate.
Well, as they said in the movie once, you knew the job was dangerous when you took it, but I think there's a power in that. There's a quality that makes us kind of sort of lean in a little bit, because we feel that need from these characters to communicate this thing that makes sense to no one but them. And I think that's something that's unique to the way you work. And clearly, even going back to Static, and they're often, sometimes grand ideas, but clearly they're these things that have these huge emotional stakes for these characters. And that's obviously something that you've always connected with.
Well, I guess when I found filmmaking at around, you know, 13, 14 years old, I guess I had found my medium that I felt I could communicate more clearly for some reason with this particular way of putting things across. And so, you know, it sounds corny, but, you know, movies kind of saved my life. It's I never know how to comment on these observations, because they're this sort of like Freudian observations, and I'm like, okay, I guess so.
Well, I'm not trying to come off as Freudian, believe me, but I ask this just because, and we've talked about this before, there's a real emotional power in your work that doesn't often come from momentum, but it's from this settling sense of gravity starting to push down on the characters, the protagonists, and on us. And obviously that's something you felt that imagery could give you the opportunity to get across to people.
Well, listen, this was the plum assignment of the last few years, to be the filmmaker, to get to try and set the tone and set the table of how we're going to cinematize these really brilliant paintings by Simon. They're really striking, and there's a reason why the whole world is sort of that's been exposed to them has responded to them so strongly. And then to have such incredible collaborators, because Nathaniel really, we just really clicked together and worked. And I guess I'm attracted to, you know, you got to have somebody with a problem in a movie or you ain't got much of a story. And I guess the problems that I'm drawn to are the problems of outsiders trying to find ways to connect. This poor little girl wants to connect to her mother, but her mother is too obsessed with her work in physics. And then now she's lost her mother, a little girl has lost her mother. Like, it's such an essential, primal, archetypal kind of story. And then to have the opportunity to tell a story like that that's already quite kind of striking, you know, it works solidly as storytelling in an original world that we got to build. I mean, how awesome. You know, Kubrick once said in an interview that I'm just trying to make films that are more daring and more sincere. And to me, that's, I always remembered that, those two things. It's sort of like a great objective definition of what makes something maybe have the potential for some more lasting value. It's kind of daring and just kind of sincere, not kind of sincere. You have to be fully sincere, but sometimes you can only be so daring. Everyone can't make 2001 A Space Odyssey right off the bat. But what I'm saying is, I'm just looking for something I haven't quite seen before, but I don't want it to be full of shit. And those things are rarer than you think. And when I read this script and saw these daring paintings, and, you know, I got very, very engaged creatively and had a very good experience. And I'm very proud of the pilot.
Oh, it's the treat. We're talking to a man who's probably revealing too much from himself today, Mark Romanek. His newest project for Amazon is the series Tales from the Loop. And I guess, you know, you said movies saved you. Talk about that a little bit, because I was thinking back to the story, I guess, about you meeting Keith Gordon on the set of Brian De Palma's Home Movies.
Yeah, well, I was like 17 or 18 years old by then, so I had already kind of been a movie filmmaker, nerdy, you know, late 70s, nerdy kid with a Super 8 camera already. You know, I was really in the perfect place at the perfect time. You know, I was a lonely, you know, kind of nerdy kid, and wasn't that good at sports. You know, one of those kids. There's millions of them. And then my dad bought me a good camera once because he sensed I had an interest in photography, and he built me a darkroom. So I started taking pictures, and then I realized I could borrow my uncle's Super 8 camera, which was just used for holidays and, you know, waving at the camera on the beach or something. I said, you know, maybe I could make like a little story movie or something. And this is like a year before Star Wars and Jaws hit. So I'm starting to fiddle around with Super 8 movies, and then Jaws comes out and Star Wars comes out, and I'm already a cinephile looking at foreign films. And so I could see that cinema could be Jaws, but I went to a public high school in Chicago called New Trier East, where the teachers came from the Art Institute of Chicago, and they were teaching these 15-year-old impressionable suburban kids avant-garde non-narrative cinema, like Stan Brakhage and Kenneth Anger and Michael Snow and Jonas Mekas, and they were blowing our minds. They were like these hippies came to blow these suburban kids' minds. So I'm watching Jonas Mekas at school, and I'm seeing Jaws on the weekend, and I'm making Super 8 films, and it became my thing. You know, and I was lucky enough to know at about 15, a light bulb went off, and I said, I think I want this to be my job. And when you're a kid, you know when it's fickle and you know when it's like real. And I knew it was that I'd found it. You know, this is what I'm going to do. I'm 60 years old and I've been doing it since that light bulb went off, you know. So, and it's provided me with this ridiculous, crazy life where I've gotten to meet and work with some of my idols and incredible actors and, you know, traveled the world. It's just the greatest. It saved my life. It gave me a life.
It's funny because you're saying that. I was thinking about, you know, in almost in totemic terms, what the camera means in this episode of Tales from the Loop. And I wondered if the first time you had a camera in your hand, if it felt like something that you knew almost in some instinctive way what to do with.
I would say that's true, but I would also say that my father taught me some stuff. You know, my father was a photo bug and always had good cameras And as I said, you know, he built me a darkroom at when I was 12 years old. So he would teach me the rudiments of composition. And, you know, it's nice to put something in the foreground, or it's nice to have this tree hanging over, you know, the top of the frame. You know, he was a real estate developer, but he was also an architect and, you know, had a lot of aesthetic sensibilities. So I remember he bought me an Instamatic camera on a trip to Disneyland. And my first real experience of really thinking about taking pictures and trying to make them better than snapshots was at Disneyland as about a 9-year-old with an Instamatic, you know, the kind with the flash cube, you know, that rotated on top.
I remember that vividly. What were you doing? I mean, you were aware of composition at that age already?
Yeah, 10 years old in Disneyland, my dad was helping me take better photographs. Not in a snotty way. He was just giving me tips because he saw I had an interest. And then I started to learn, oh, that's a shit photograph and that's a good photograph. Or that's a traditional photograph and that's a slightly more original way to look at it photograph, you know. And then I got obsessed with photography. Then I discovered D.N. Arbus, you know, and that blew my mind. That was as seminal, finding that Arbus, you know, what do you call it when it's that a book of a photographer, a monograph. When I found that Aperture monograph, it was in our high school library. I just pulled it off the shelf. I remember it very clearly. And I opened up the book. I don't even know why I was attracted to it. I had no idea who D.N. Arbus was. And when I started turning the pages of that book, it was as powerful to me as seeing 2001 A Space Odyssey with my dad when I was 9. I don't know why. It was a way of appreciating and loving and framing humans in such a courageous and intimate way, and yet with this quality of going on some sort of like of adventure to find these strange examples of humanity, and then see the humanity within them, and not just shoot them as freaks. I mean, I haven't really talked about that much. I don't know why I'm bringing it up now, just because of this psychotherapy session, but. Arbus was a big influence on me.
I guess I wondered what it must have been like too, because as a kid in Chicago, to have Brian De Palma show up, because I guess you met him when you were shooting The Fury there, and have somebody whose work you clearly must have paid attention to and saw that kind of concentrated effort that we're talking about, and that affinity for imagery and for the psychological import of imagery, and to get a chance to be on the set like that and to see somebody like that work must have made you think, yes, this is a place for me.
Well, it was very glamorous. You know, I got a job as a PA when I was about 17 or 16 years old on Brian De Palma's The Fury. And it was really like getting a ticket to the Emerald City, or so. It's like the thing that you just didn't know I didn't know what went on the other side of that, you know, some sawhorse where they keep the looky-loos back, you know, but to be on the other side of the sawhorse amongst the crew. And then I learned slowly that it's not magic. It's a labor-intensive, industrial-feeling hard work of hammering and nailing things and pushing things and lifting things, and as well as all the delicate stuff of the nuance of a performance or a motif you're trying to express. And I found that to be a huge relief, because I honestly thought there was something magical about it that I would never be able to comprehend. You know, there's immense amounts of incredibly grinding, mundane stuff that is probably 80% of filmmaking, you know?
Well, I have to say, I mean, we could really do this all day, but we're out of time. And I can't thank you enough for doing this, Mark. Thank you so much.
Oh, I always love talking with you, Elvis, and I hope you're doing okay. And it's good to hear your voice. It's always a soothing thing to hear.
Well, it's terrific talking to you, and it's a terrific piece of work. Of course, what we're talking about is the Amazon series Tales from the Loop, directed by our guest, Mark Romantic. Recording engineer somewhere out there at KCRW is Kat. You're also going to edit this. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Well, to better days, everybody. It's The Treatment. Shake it, don't break it. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.